Hello, this is Mikey, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 21st issue of the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. So, let's see what we've got here on this front page. Okay. From Mexico to Ireland, fury mounts over global AI frenzy. Well, let's see how this one looks, huh? There's a picture of somewhere. All greenery and one huge, huge, huge plant. Let's find out exactly where it is, huh? When Microsoft opened a data center in central Mexico last year, nearby residents said power cuts became more frequent. Water outages, which once lasted days, stretched for weeks. And this is the picture we're looking at. The shortages led to school cancellations and the spread of stomach bugs in the town of Las Cienas. And Dulce Maria Nicholas, a resident and mother of two, she has considered moving. We have a picture of her. Looks as though she lives in a concrete walled home. And she's sitting between two, obviously, children's beds with lots of colorful things around and stuffed toys on them. Victor Barenas, who runs a local healthcare clinic, has stitched up children by flashlight. In December, he was unable to give oxygen to a 54-year-old farmer because the power went out. The patient was rushed to a hospital nearly an hour away. And we have a picture here with Dr. Barenas using an ultrasound on a very pregnant lady. Let's see what we've got next. Their experiences are being echoed elsewhere as an artificial intelligence building boom strains already fragile power and water infrastructures in communities around the world. From Mexico to Ireland, fury mounts over a global AI frenzy. Excuse me. As tech companies build data centers worldwide to advance artificial intelligence, vulnerable communities have been hit by blackouts and water shortages. This is written by Paul Moser, Adam Santoriano, and Emilio Rodriguez Mega. The United States has been the nexus of a data center bloom as OpenAI, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and others invest hundreds of billions to build giant computing sites in the name of advancing artificial intelligence. But the companies have also exported the construction frenzy abroad with less scrutiny. Nearly 60% of the 1,244 largest data centers in the world were outside the United States as of the end of June, according to an analysis by Synergy Research Group, which studies the industry. More are coming, with at least 575 data center projects in development globally from companies including Tencent, Meta, and Alibaba. As data centers rise, the sites, which need vast amounts of power for computing and water to cool the computers, have contributed or exacerbated to disruptions not only in Mexico, but in more than a dozen other countries, according to the New York Times examination. In Ireland, data centers consume more than 20% of the country's electricity. In Chile, precious aquifers are in danger of depletion. In South Africa, where blackouts have long been routine, data centers are fully taxing the national grid. Similar concerns have surfaced in Brazil, Britain, India, Malaysia, the Netherlands, Singapore, and Spain. Issues have been compounded by a lack of transparency. Google, Amazon, Microsoft and other tech companies often work through subsidiaries and service providers to build data centers, masking their presence and revealing little about the resources that the facilities consume. Many governments are eager for an AI foothold, too. They have provided cheap land, tax breaks, and access to resources, and are taking a hands-off approach to regulations and closures and disclosures. Tech companies, which are racing to build data centers to power new AI models and create, quote, superintelligence, unquote, or AI with power that exceeds the human brain, said the boom brought jobs and investments. They added that they were working to shrink their environmental footprint by generating their own energy and recycling water. Microsoft said it had no information that its data center complex in central Mexico had affected power and water supplies. Electricity is unusable there, the company said. It added that it used minimal water and had an electricity load up to 12.6 megawatts, which, if used throughout the year, would be the equivalent of what could power roughly 50,000 homes in Mexico. We looked deeply and found no indication that our data centers have contributed to blackouts or water shortages in the region, said Bowen Wallace, Microsoft Corporate Vice President for Data Centers in the Americas. We will always prioritize the basic needs of the community. Electric grids infrastructure has been problematic in central Mexico and caused blackouts, said Alejandro Sterling, the director of industrial development for the region. Quote, our capacity has been overdrawn, he said. Directly linking any data center to local power and water shortages is difficult. Yet buildings in areas with unstable grids and existing water strains has pressured already frail systems, according to experts, increasing the potential for cascading effects. In country after country, activists, residents, and environmental organizations have banded together to oppose data centers. Some have tried blocking the projects, while others have pushed for more oversight and transparency. In Ireland, authorities have limited new data centers in the Dublin area because of, quote, significant risk, unquote, to power supplies. After activists protested in Chile, Google withdrew plans to build a center that could have depleted water reserves. In the Netherlands, construction was halted on some data centers over environmental concerns. Data centers are where environmental and social issues meet, said Rosie Leonard, an environmentalist with Friends of the Earth Ireland. You have this narrative that data centers are needed and will make us rich and thriving, but this is a real crisis. There are a few signs of a slowdown. Companies are expected to spend $375 billion on data centers globally this year and $500 billion in 2026, according to the investment bank UBS. In Mexico, residents said data center development should come with more investment in their communities. Excuse me. In the village of La Esperanza, near Microsoft's site, there was a hepatitis outbreak this summer. Water outages left residents unable to wash their hands or maintain basic hygiene. The disease spread quickly, and about 50 people got sick, said Dr. Victor Barcenas, who runs... I'm sorry. Excuse me. Sorry, who runs a local health clinic, the person we saw in the pictures coming in. Quote, I blame the state governments for failing to negotiate support for the community, he said. Microsoft's project involves millions of dollars of investment, and none of it went to us, to the people. An environmental movement. And we have a picture here of two horses walking in a beautiful green area with really thick grass. Horses roam the 150 acres of open fields in the town of Ennis in Western Ireland, which a developer began to turn into a 4 billion euro data center for an unnamed tech company 5 years ago. Environmental groups and locals have filed legal objections and appeals to block the project. Not long ago, such a plan would probably have sailed through. For two decades, Ireland rolled out the red carpet for tech. Apple, Microsoft, Google, and TikTok made the country their European base, and about 120 data centers are clustered around Dublin and dot the countryside beyond. A third of the country's electricity is expected to go to data centers in the next few years, up from 5%, wow, in 2015. But Ireland's welcoming mood has soured. The country has become one of the clearest examples of the transitional backlash against data centers. That opposition gained momentum in 2021 when an environmental socialist group, People Before Profit, protested at a data center conference in Dublin. Around the same time, residents in County Clare, where Ennis is, challenged the proposed facility that would be built on farmland. Since then, a protest movement has grown. Local residents, including the best-selling author Sally Rooney, have raised concerns. Last year, Dara Adelaide, an activist with People Before Profit, was elected to South Dublin County Council, which later rejected a data center application from Google. In January, storms caused power outages across Western Ireland, fueling debates over whether the grid was at a breaking point. There's a reason why the grid is under strain, and it's because of the disproportionate number of data centers, said Sinead Sheehan, an activist who organized a petition against the Ennis project that was signed by more than 1,000 people. Ireland's experience is a warning. By 2035, data centers globally are projected to use about as much electricity as India, the world's most populous country, according to the International Energy Agency. A single data center can also use more than 500,000 gallons of water a day, nearly as much as an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Environmental groups worldwide are sharing information, tactics, and resources to push back. And there's a picture of one of these plants. And it looks just like every other kind of plant that you would see. There's one really high concrete looking pillar. It's probably not concrete. And lots and lots and lots of things that look, that are shorter to the ground than I would have expected, than our electricity coils and modules and things. But it's just covered with them. In Spain, Aurora Gomez Delgado, an environmentalist who protested a Meta facility near Madrid in 2023, was stunned when messages of support poured in from abroad. Today, she coordinates with dozens of groups worldwide. Her group, Tu Nube Seca Mi Rio, Your Cloud Dries Up My River, helped inspire the creation of another group in France. There's nowhere that doesn't have a data center, Ms. Gomez Delgado said. We're coordinated. We're talking to each other all the time. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. She and her colleagues said they realized it would be an uphill fight. In Ireland, even with limitations on data centers near Dublin, the authorities are trying to expedite the approvals of other sites in rural areas like County Clare and County Mayo. Many in the business community support further development. Environmentalists in Ireland have lost appeals against data center construction in courts, but hope their actions will deter companies. On September 30th, about 50 people protested outside Dublin's parliament against more data centers. And we have a picture of these folks. Don't leave renters out in the cold. Heat our homes, not our planet. A final legal, wow, and there's a lot of them on the street. A final legal appeal against the Ennis Data Center must still be heard. Even if the project is greenlit, its future is in question. Amazon recently revealed it was behind the project and had pulled out, meaning when the local developer will need to find another tech company to partner with. We are committed to being a good neighbor, so we spend a lot of time listening to and understanding a community's needs and priorities, the company said in a statement. Welcoming policies. Now we've got this picture that I described to you before with this huge data center and lots of greenery around and mountains in the background. And this is in El Marques, Querétaro, in Mexico. Sorry for my Spanish, it's terrible. In a gleaming office tower wrapped in solar panels and a 3D LED screen in the city of Querétaro in central Mexico, an official spearheading the country's transformation into a data center hub said interruptions to power and water were the price of progress. Those are happy problems, said Mr. Sterling, the director of industrial developments for Querétaro, where many of Mexico's 110 data centers are. Not for the people that suffer it, but for the development of the place. And there's a picture of a young man here, and this is Alejandro Sterling, and he looks to be in his 20s. It is a refrain echoed, if often less bluntly, by officials elsewhere as they woo tech companies. Brazil is creating new tax breaks. Malaysia carved out an industrial zone to attract Chinese and Silicon Valley firms. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia ran a diplomatic campaign to get support from President Trump to buy prized AI chips that companies need. The European Union has vowed to spend billions on new regional data centers. Dara O'Brien, Ireland's Minister for Climate, Energy, and the Environment, said construction was migrating to countries with the most welcoming policies. A very important part of our industrial strategy is being at the leading edge of new technologies and data, he said. Government support worldwide has helped tech firms build with little accountability, said Anna Valdivia, an Oxford University lecturer studying data center developments. Few environmental regulations were designed for data centers, and the companies often demand some level of secrecy from governments. In Mexico, Mr. Sterling described an ambitious growth plan that would quadruple total electricity use from data centers to 1.5 gigawatts over the next 5 years, roughly the amount used by 1.25 million American homes. Non-disclosure agreements with tech companies were needed to win the deals, he said, and he was required to keep information from communities and Mexico's electricity utility. I signed that NDA as a public service, he said. Project operators are often camouflaged through subsidiaries or outside contractors. In Mexico, at least one Microsoft data center is owned and operated by Ascenty, a Latin American data center company. In Ireland, the would-be Amazon data center was developed by a firm called Art Data Centers. This is an aerial view of a data center on a hazy day in Santiago, and it looks kind of like the pictures we saw of industrial projects in the United States and elsewhere. There's nothing but gray. There's two green tanks that are huge, and the rest of the thing is absolutely gray because the sky is gray. The buildings are all covered, and the stacks that have the smoke coming out of them, there's quite a few of them, probably 10. Company representatives and government officials said new technology, including cooling systems that recycle water, was helping to solve the resource strains. Data centers use a lot of water. They don't waste a lot of water, Mr. Sterling said. Teresa Roldan, an activist in Mexico, said she was skeptical of a new proposal in Querétaro to recycle sewage for public drinking water. The government has said the plan would serve citizens and industry, but data center companies already have direct access to groundwater, she said. Residents would end up with filtered sewage water, she said. Microsoft's data center complex in central Mexico rises more than 800 feet atop a hill in the high Mesquite Plains north of Mexico City. It is prime land. Locals, including indigenous groups, had long grazed animals at a natural spring there. Today, the space is fenced off. Drone footage shows a new reservoir inside, surrounded by fresh dirt. Data centers arrived in Querétaro about 5 years ago, drawn by the proximity to the United States, relative safety from drug violence, and a local government eager to welcome multinationals. Microsoft came first, followed by Amazon and Google. Soon, industrial parks buzzed with construction crews. And we've got a picture of a new site going up with a big concrete truck. And this is in Querétaro. Impoverished small towns in the area, which have struggled with basic services, began experiencing longer water shortages and more blackouts. According to more than a dozen residents, there are patients with kidney failure who need their machines for treatment, said Manuel Rodriguez, a local government representative. There are people with diabetes who need to keep their medication refrigerated. Mexico's national power company attributed recent outages to lightning strikes and stray animals running into equipment. Residents have been hit financially by the power and water disruptions. In Viboreales, a town near the data centers, Elizabeth Sanchez and her neighbors began experiencing water outages in June 2024. They now split a $60 fee for private water trucks. Ms. Sanchez, a 39-year-old homemaker, also has tossed spoiled food after electric outages. A recent blackout fried her daughter's computer and the refrigerator. We can't keep up, so we adapt, Ms. Sanchez said, adding that a prime-time job as a courier has helped defray the cost. Dulce Maria Nicholas, 30, the mother of two in Las Cienas, who owns a convenience store, said the blackouts had twice forced her to dump rotting food from her family refrigerator this summer, while prolonged water cuts pushed her to buy more jugs for storing water. It's a double cost, she said. Her children have gotten stomach bugs when the family cannot wash dishes properly, and school has been canceled when the toilets don't flush. The children were focused mostly on the electricity outages, which deprive them of their phones. Technology is all he sees, she said of her 11-year-old. The timing of the problems. After Microsoft's data center complex became operational, pointed to one culprit, Ms. Nicholas said. They have all the electricity, she said of the tech company. I'm left with nothing. It's quite an article. Now we'll go back, hopefully, to the front page. We did. let's see. A squalid building, a tip to the feds, then straight up chaos. An immigration raid on an apartment building in Chicago followed years of problems with crime and neglect by landlords. It swept up dozens of U.S. citizens who were detained in the middle of the night. So let's see. On a humid September night in Chicago, Cameo Polk was asleep in his fifth-floor apartment when he heard the thump, thump, thump of a helicopter overhead. Outside, hundreds of men with masks and rifles were scurrying around the building. He briefly wondered if an invasion was underway, but they were U.S. law enforcement agents, rappelling from a Black Hawk helicopter and swarming the 130-unit building he lives in. Once inside, they kicked down doors, emptied bookshelves, and overturned mattresses. By dawn, at least 37 of Mr. Polk's neighbors, nearly all the Venezuelan nationals, would be in the custody of the U.S. government, part of President Trump's plan to crack down on illegal immigration. Trailed by drones and a camera crew, the federal agents with their guns drawn carried out one of the most aggressive immigration operations in recent memory. The raid has become a defining image of the Trump administration's surge of federal agents into Chicago, where masked immigration officers for weeks have been chasing down people suspected of being in the country illegally. And while those arrests have drawn fierce protests, the apartment building raid, which took place on April 30th, raised even more concern. In their effort to capture Venezuelans, agents led by the U.S. Border Patrol pulled dozens of American citizens from their apartments in the middle of the night, pointing their guns at sleepy men and women before zip-tying them and taking them outside. The operation also highlighted the extent to which the immigration enforcement and crime fighting have become intertwined as bevies of officers from various federal agencies have been sent into American cities. The building, targeted by Border Patrol because undocumented immigrants live there, has long been a hotbed of drug use and violence, residents said. The raid focused on a mud-colored brick building that rises 5 stories tall and sits across from an elementary school in the predominantly Black neighborhood of South Shore along Lake Michigan. Residents said the living conditions have been poor for some time and had worsened in the last year as more people squatted in empty apartments, and the management company, the landlord, and the city government remained unresponsive to their pleas to fix the place up. There have been nearly 500 calls to emergency services regarding the building so far this year, records show, and the city and a bank has been pressuring the landlord to make improvements. Some residents said after the raid they hoped it might give the building a new start. And there's a picture of the building with all sorts of trash and debris down the hallway after the raid. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. But what unfolded that night was an ordeal spanning several hours that left residents, Venezuelans, and Americans alike terror-stricken and humiliated. They bolted out of their beds at the sound of heavy footsteps in the darkened hallways, splintering doors, flashbang grenades, excuse me, and sparked commands. Restrained at the wrist, interrogated, and separated by race and ethnicity, residents were forced onto buses while armed federal agents checked their names and records, determining whether they were living in the country legally or not. Mr. Polk and his brother, Nate Howard, were not immigrants, but they were forced from their apartment anyway, and his brother was arrested after a federal agent found that he had missed a court date related to a years-old drug charge. I don't understand how they decided to do that too. They didn't treat people like they were American. The building. On this side, the residents of 7500 South Shore Drive could agree. The building was full of danger. The conditions inside were squalid, with mold, broken pipes, and the persistent reek of urine in the darkened stairwells. Drugs, gangs, prostitution, said Twana Pickens, 44, who had lived in the building for 3 years until she moved out this summer. Anything illegal, name it. It happened there. It's just a very unsafe environment for people who just want to come home, go to work, and try to raise their families there. Former residents said elevators were routinely broken. The mail was not delivered, and trash was regularly left in the hallways. One person said she was once followed by a man with his penis in his hand, asking for sex. Steve Jordan, 34, said he had long lived within blocks of the apartment building, and he knew it as a place where people bought drugs and went to get warm in the winter. A lot of people go in there because there are empty apartments and no locks on a lot of the doors, he said. Excuse me. Residents said that the Americans and the Venezuelans in the building generally left each other alone, but the immigrants sometimes had conflicts among themselves and upset other tenants. Some of them were bad boys, I must say, said Eleanor McMullen, 64, who lives on the third floor. Sometimes they would break doors and bust the lights out. Foolish stuff, because they were young, unquote. But she was friends with some of the immigrants who greeted her when they passed in the hallways. She gave a tricycle that belonged to one of her grandchildren to one man's little girl. So sorry. We talked every day, she said. He would knock on my door and be like, oh, I'm home. In recent months, the violence in the building escalated. A Venezuelan man, Gregory Arias, 31, was fatally shot in an apartment in the building in June, in what federal officials described as a, quote, brutal execution-style murder, unquote. On September 8th, officers with the Chicago Police Department arrested another Venezuelan, Jose Coronado Meza, 25, in connection to the murder. At the time of the raid, the owner, Trinity Flood, a Wisconsin woman who purchased the apartment building in 2020 for $11.3 million, had been under legal pressure to improve conditions. Ms. Flood did not return calls and emails seeking comment. Corey Oliver, the owner of Strength and Management, the property management company that handled the property, also did not return requests for comment. Wells Fargo had sued Ms. Flood in April, seeking to foreclose on three Chicago apartment buildings that she had purchased in 2020 for about $18 million, including the one on South Shore Drive. Chicago officials met with property managers in June and instructed them to install burglar bars on vacant units and to work with police to remove squatters. A lawyer for the city wrote in August of flooding in the laundry room, urine in the stairwell, and armed occupants, unquote, with criminal activity and shootings taking place. Ms. Flood's lawyers, told the court on September 26 that the owner had spent $2 million on repairs, maintenance, and security and evictions since 2020. They said that managers had invested hundreds of hours working with law enforcement to stop the squatters and criminals from entering the building. In response to the continuing complaints, the judge set a hearing on an emergency motion for the appointment of a receiver, giving the parties a court date of October 1st. About 24 hours before the hearing, federal agents raided the building. The raid. The operation began with a confidential tip, officials said. Officials have not said who tipped them off, but records show that agents carried out the raid with the consent of the owner and that they targeted apartments that they were told were not currently being rented and were presumably occupied by squatters. Several residents said that agents had left some apartments alone while bursting into others. Maya Hill, 22, said some residents who peeked into the hallway during the raid were ordered to go back inside. One man who asked not to be identified because he was still living in the building said he found a floor plan of the building in the aftermath of the raid, with some apartments shaded in green, others in white, and some in red. Brian McGraw, 64, who lives on the first floor and was not targeted by the agents, said that he later found orange tape on his door with the words "no go" written on it. Two other doors on the first floor had similar tape, he said. They must have had some advance intelligence or information, where somehow they knew I wasn't one of the ones they were looking for, he said. Border Patrol officials, who were accompanied on the raid by officers from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, and other agencies, said that among those arrested were people they believed to be members of the Venezuelan criminal gang Tren de Aragua. The intelligence was showing that they would move about inside the apartment complex freely and known to carry weapons inside the apartment complex. David Kim, an assistant chief patrol agent at Border Patrol, said in an interview. Another Border Patrol official who did not agree to be named because he works undercover said that the gang members were squatting in units and extorting people in the complex, and that the building owner had not been able to get them out. Just after 1 a.m. on the night of the raid, Mr. McGraw, the first floor resident, peered out of his apartment's first floor windows and saw federal officers approach and cut through the back door with the power saw. As the federal agents roamed through the hallway, Mr. McGraw heard one of them say, "There's a whole village on the second floor," unquote. On the fifth floor, Keisha Clark's apartment door came crashing down as federal agents battered their way in and then tossed a flashbang grenade. Miss Clark, a 43-year-old American, said that federal agents had grabbed her, scratching her left arm, put her wrists in restraints, and took her out of the apartment. "Clearly you can see that we're American," she said, recalling her fury at the treatment. "Why are we in handcuffs?" Brian Boyd, a tenant, 56, and a lifelong Chicagoan, woke up in a state of shock when he saw what he felt like was an army of agents swarming the building. "They were just on straight-up chaos," he said. "The agents forced everyone to line up. Keep your focus ahead," they told residents as they marched them downstairs and outside into the night. They brought them through a fence into a school parking lot where dozens of people were collected, including Venezuelan children and their mothers, some of them only partly clothed because they had been pulled out of bed, witnesses said. Ebony Watson, who lives next to the building, said she had seen a federal agent with a group of Venezuelans forcibly remove a baby from its mother's arms. Venezuelans were separated from Americans, and some residents were placed on buses for at least an hour, they said. Officers checked people's names to see if they had any open warrants before letting them go. Excuse me. Ms. McMullen on the third floor was briefly detained with several Venezuelans who she said had been squatting in the building. After being questioned and remaining on a bus for hours, she was allowed to go back to her apartment. "My bed was turned upside down," she said. "My mattress and stuff flipped over. My paperwork and stuff just thrown out." Mr. Kim of the Border Patrol said agents arrested anyone who was not legally in the country, whether or not the person was an original target of the raid. "Well, guess what," he said. "You're coming with us," unquote. Aid groups, lawyers, and journalists have all had difficulty identifying and locating many of the Venezuelans who were taken by immigration agents. Federal officials have only publicly identified most of them, and have not said where they are, making it impossible to verify their claims about the immigrants' criminal histories. Three people whom the New York Times was able to identify as being arrested in the raid had no criminal histories. Mr. Polk and his brother was let out of jail the day after the raid and returned home. It was not long before state and local officials in Chicago protested the actions of the federal agents, saying they had acted with unnecessary aggression. "This raid wasn't about public safety," Mayor Brandon Johnson said several days later. "It was certainly not about immigration. This was a show of authoritarianism, a forced display of tyranny." Days after the raid, a walk through the building showed the aftermath of the destruction and efforts to clean it up. Debris was being cleared and light bulbs replaced. In the front courtyard, workers trimmed branches from overgrown trees and removed broken window panes from a third-floor unit. And there's a picture here with window frames broken. One has plywood covering it up. And the fencing around the building is pushed in. And there's debris around. Roderick Johnson, 67, a longtime resident, said he was still suffering from the trauma of the raid, recalling federal agents breaking into his apartment with flashbang grenades while he was trying to sleep. Now he has a new fear that the building will be sold and then the new management will evict him. The way it looks, they're trying to close the building down. Wow. That's something, huh? Okay, now we'll go back to the front page again, and we'll just use this time in between to remind you that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, let's see what else is on the front page. Wealthy Americans are spending, people with less are struggling. Let's see what this article's about. And this picture looks exactly like the pictures from the, oh, it's a food pantry in Chicago. And there's a long line of folks with shopping carts, the kind you buy for yourself, the long, skinny ones, outside a food pantry. And they're loading up the carts and loading up bags and boxes and other things. The divide between rich and poor is hardly new in Chicago or the rest of the country, but it has been more pronounced in recent months. And this is outside the Pilsen food pantry in Chicago. By the time the Pilsen food pantry opened on a recent morning, Ulysses Moreno had been there for 2 hours, with a line of people behind him that snaked around the corner. "This is a lifeline for me," said Mr. Moreno, 39. He had lost his construction job a few days earlier, and with three teenagers at home, he wanted to make sure he could stock up. "Our food budget doesn't stretch as far as it used to." A few miles away on Chicago's glitzy, magnificent mile, luxury hotels are bustling. Jewelry stores and designer boutiques do brisk business. Restaurants are packed with diners sipping $20 cocktails while they wait for tables. To Evelyn Figueroa, a family physician who founded and runs the Pilsen Pantry, the dichotomy is striking. "For people like me, who are homeowners, who are employed, the economy is great," she said. "How is the economy? It depends on who you're looking at," unquote. The divide between rich and poor is hardly new in Chicago or the rest of the country, but it has become more pronounced in recent months. Wealthier Americans, buoyed by a stock market that keeps setting records, have continued to spend freely. Lower income households, stung by persistent inflation and navigating a labor market that's losing momentum, are pulling back. The top 10% of 200 of U.S. households now account for nearly half of all spending. Wow. The top 10% of U.S. households now account for nearly half of all spending. Wow, that's an interesting statistic. Moody's Analytics recently estimated the highest share since the 1980s. Consumer sentiment has climbed among high earners, but steadily fallen for other groups. This isn't just an inequality story. This is a microeconomic story, said Lindsay Owens, executive director of the Groundwork Collaborative, a progressive policy group. As the wealthy continue to consume, that's masking more and more insecurity and instability in the economy under the hood. The split is evident across industries. Well-to-do flyers are snapping up pricey seats and first and business class as airlines struggle to fill the cheaper seats at the back of the plane. Credit card companies are competing to offer ever more expensive cards to high earners who are happy to pay the annual fees in return for exclusive perks, while lower income households are struggling to make minimum payments on their debts. Even executives at companies that project mass market appeal are seeing the trend, in some cases worrying about its implications. Visits across the industry by low-income consumers once again declined by double visits, double digits. I'm sorry. This is kind of a unwieldy sentence. Visits across the industry by low-income consumers once again declined by double digits versus the prior year period. Christopher K. Kemzinski, chief executive of McDonald's, said on a recent earnings call, "This bifurcated consumer base is why we remain cautious about the overall near-term health of the U.S. consumer. Inequality narrowed by many measures during the pandemic, when trillions of dollars in government aid flowed to households and businesses, and many companies provided extra pay to employees who could not work from home. When the economy began to reopen, intense competition for workers led to rapid wage growth, particularly in low-paying sectors where demand for labor far outstripped supply. But as the labor market has cooled, low-wage workers have lost much of that leverage. Hourly wages are rising most slowly for the lowest-paid workers, reversing the pandemic trend, according to data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Slower wage growth combined with persistent inflation is straining many families' finances. Americans are increasingly relying on credit cards and other forms of borrowing to pay their bills, and more are falling behind on car loans and credit card payments. Those strains have not resulted in widespread defaults, bankruptcies, or foreclosures. But high debt balances mean that even people who are keeping up with payments have little room to borrow more if their costs rise or their incomes fail. And data on spending from Numerator, a consumer research firm, shows that lower income households have cut back on discretionary purchases, leaving them little buffer. People are still consuming the basics, but they're cutting back on all this extra stuff they were able to do coming out of the pandemic, said Leo Feller, chief economist at Numerator. It's just more precarious because if we've already trimmed all the fat, the only thing left to trim are the essentials. Pressure on lower income families was building long before President Trump returned to office. But some of the administration's policies have worsened the challenge, particularly in certain communities. Farmers have been hit hard by Mr. Trump's trade war with China. Cuts to the federal workforce have taken a toll in Northern Virginia and other parts of the country that depend heavily on government employment, effects aggravated by the government shutdown. And immigration raids are weighing on industries that rely on foreign-born workers and on the businesses that count them as customers. In Pilsen, a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood on the west side of Chicago, the normally bustling streets have become quiet in recent weeks amid increased immigration enforcement. Lawn signs in Spanish remind residents of their legal rights. Local businesses say they are seeing fewer customers. Dr. Figueroa said that her food pantry was getting more requests to have groceries delivered because families were afraid to venture out. "There's a lot of need," she said. "I'm always trying to think, what's the next emergency?" Sources of fragility. The hardship in Pilsen and other communities has been largely hidden in the macroeconomic data, however. Consumer spending continues to outpace inflation. Household debt levels have risen, but are manageable relative to the Americans' incomes. Broad measures like gross domestic product point to an economy that has slowed but remains fundamentally healthy, surprising many forecasters. But that resilience increasingly rests on a relative handful of well-off households. economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston recently found that growth in consumer spending in 2022 has been propelled by the highest income consumers. By contrast, the researchers noted, spending growth for low-income consumers, has been much weaker. The divergence creates two sources of fragility, Warren Dieran Pachty, an author of the Boston Fed study. With so much riding on high earners, the economy could suffer if stock prices fall or if some other shock leads them to pare their spending. And lower income houses are already stressed financially, leaving them vulnerable if the labor market weakens further. The bifurcated picture is a challenge for policymakers at the Federal Reserve. Strong consumer demand could keep pressure on prices while tariffs are fueling concerns about inflation. But if the central bank keeps interest rates high to fight inflation, cracks forming in the labor market could widen. The unemployment rate has crept higher in recent months, but remains relatively low at 4.3% in August, the most recent data available, because the federal government shutdown delayed the release of September figures. Hiring has slowed drastically in recent months, but companies, for the most part, are holding on to workers. If companies begin making widespread cuts, the consumer picture could darken quickly, warned Michelle Meyer, chief economist at MasterCard. If we actually see an increase in firing rates, if you see an increase in the unemployment rate, if you see wages really start to slow in a meaningful way, then I think that even if household balance sheets are still supported, the storyline changes very rapidly. For people who are out of work, finding a job has already gotten far more difficult. Nearly 2 million Americans are considered long-term unemployed, the highest since the pandemic. And joblessness has risen sharply for black workers, recent graduates, and other groups that are often the first to feel the effects of a weakening labor market. This month, dozens of job seekers packed into a nondescript conference room in the Pilsen neighborhood for a career fair hosted by the National ABLE Network, a workforce development nonprofit based in Chicago. Some of the attendees had jobs but wanted better opportunities or were looking for a backup plan amid layoff rumors. Some were recent graduates looking for a foot in the door. But most had lost jobs, in many cases, months or even years before. A social worker laid off when the suicide hotline she worked for lost government funding. A public relations expert who moved back home to Chicago to advance her career, then fell victim to a corporate downsizing. Information technology specialist who lost a job at Chicago Public Schools more than a year ago and hasn't worked since. When Jocelyn Saunders lost her job at a financial services firm in December 2023, she expected to find a new role relatively quickly. She had a bachelor's degree and years of experience and had never been out of work for long. Nearly two years later, Ms. Saunders, 40, showed up to the career fair still looking for a job. She has earned certifications in data analysis, which had seemed like a growth area, but companies are cutting jobs, and those that are hiring are looking for people with experience in that field. She's driving for Uber while applying for jobs and buying little but food and gas for her car. "I'm just making ends meet, and that's it," she said. I'm not able to save, and I'm not able to pay down things on my credit. But what about data showing that the economy is still good? That might be true for some of the people she drops off at downtown hotels, Ms. Saunders said, but not for the people struggling to pay their bills. Good for who, she said. Listen to the people and what they are saying about what's happening right now. Even middle-class families are suffering. Wow, that's kind of an interesting article. Ah, here's an interesting one. Peanut allergies have plummeted in children, study shows. Oh, and I am out of time and won't be able to tell you about this. They've recommended that peanuts be avoided, but officially they've reversed their guidance and food allergies decreased sharply. And that's all I can tell you because I'm out of time. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 21st issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Mikey. I apologize for my coughing. Thank you for listening.